This year, we're actually going to launch. Oh, there we go. We got volume. We're going to have three groups this year. So we're starting to grow a little bit. The tribe is growing, which is awesome. So this week, this Wednesday, we're going to start one group on Wednesday evenings, our midweek group. It's going to be up in Armonk. So if you're interested in hearing any more info about that one, Debbie is going to be leading that group. And it's going to be 6:30 to 8:30. Normally, the Wednesday group meets the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. So we'll be kicking that one off. But then because, as you heard from John, we have so many different things happening in the next couple of weeks here, we're going to start two more groups in October. So there'll be a little more information about that. And you're going to hear all about what a community group is in 2 weeks. We're working through our, I guess I have volume, so we can just go. If you have your Bibles, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 28 this morning. So you can flip there or scroll there, whichever your preference is. And we're going to kick off a series here this morning all about Awaken, who we are, our vision, what it is that we're building here, hence the title of the sermon series, what we're building here. Just very simple. What we're building here, because that's what we're going to talk about over the next 4 weeks. What are we looking to accomplish? What are we after? Why do we gather here on a Sunday morning? Why do we have community groups? Why do we do anything that we do as Awaken? So over the next 4 weeks, going to be rolling out the vision of Awaken to let you know exactly where we're moving so that we can all move forward on the same page together. Now, I started Awaken 7 years ago, and from that first meeting on a Sunday evening in 2010 in my apartment, it has grown, it's evolved, it has changed drastically from 7 years ago. And so I thought, now would be a great time to revisit the vision, take a look at it, make a couple of revisions, and then to make it exactly clear for all of us what we're doing. So that we all know the direction that we're moving in, so that we can all move forward together. So if you're new here, this is a great time to join us. And if you've been here for a while, you're going to hear something maybe a little different. You're going to hear the vision being told in a little different way than maybe you've seen it before. For some of you who have been here for 7 years, you might be in for a shocker. We've changed some of it, but change is good. And I am so excited to share this with you, to roll this out. And one of the things that I've learned over 7 years, which I didn't quite get in the beginning, is that simple is best. I think in the beginning I tried making things a little too complex, and I've learned along the way, the more simple that you can be, the more clear it is for everyone. And so that's the goal, to give some clarity to who we are here at Awaken. So Matthew chapter 28, we're going to start in verse 16. And it says, then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. This is after the resurrection of Jesus. So Jesus died, resurrected, and apparently he had told disciples, hey, here's the deal, I want you guys to go to this place. We're going to have a little showdown here. And so when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. All right, it's a little side note here. Come on. You know, so often, what we tend to do with the Christian faith is we try to remove all doubt. But yet, what does Matthew tell us here? 11 disciples, those who were the closest to Jesus, and some of them doubted. As if Matthew's throwing, normally we just kind of skim right through this, but what Matthew's saying is that doubt is actually a normative experience of faith. We try to run from it, but yet what do we have here? No. Actually, the 11 disciples, yeah, some of them doubted. Some of them had some questions. Some of them were wondering, what exactly is going on here? So then Jesus came to them and he said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. Now, these are the final words that Jesus speaks to his disciples. These are his parting words. So whatever Jesus says here at the end is probably going to be pretty important, is it not? Jesus could have said anything, And yet these are the sentences that he leaves his disciples with. As if he says, here's your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to go and make disciples. So when I read this, when I think about this, it seems pretty clear that our mission here at Awaken would be to make disciples of Jesus, who make disciples, who make disciples, who make disciples, and you kind of get the picture of where we're going here. So the main mission of Awaken, the thing that we are attempting to do here, is we're looking to form disciples of Jesus. That's our mission. That's what we're doing. Now, which raises all sorts of questions, because this idea of discipleship, this idea, this word even, disciple, it's not a word that we typically use here in our world today. Any of you, do you walk around using the word disciple throughout your week? I didn't think so. So what exactly is going on here? And here's the thing. I know for some of you, you're like, ooh, disciple, that sounds kind of weird. I get it. You know, sometimes words get hijacked. I understand that. Disciple, I think oftentimes whenever we talk about it, it lacks the depth that it truly has. And so what I thought we could do here this morning is, why don't we talk about what does it mean to be a disciple? And in order to do that, we have to enter into the first century Jewish world. Because here's the deal, Jesus was Jewish. I know it's a shocker. Jesus was not Christian, Jesus was Jewish. And if you want to understand what Jesus is doing, if you want to understand what Jesus means when he's talking about disciples, you have to understand the first century Jewish context in which Jesus lived and moved and breathed. And so first up this morning, what is a disciple? What do we mean when we say this word, disciple? And then what does it mean for us in our lives? Now, if you're alive, whoa, just making sure you're all awake. Are you alive? If you're alive. All right, so now that we've figured that one out, that we're all alive. If you were alive in the first century and you were part of the Jewish community, education would have been the highest priority. Josephus, he's an ancient Jewish historian. He has this to say about education. He says, above all else, we pride ourselves on the education of our children. So education was the thing. It was the goal. It was the one main component of Jewish life. And what did education center around? The Torah, which would be the first five books of our Old Testament: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Now, the Jewish community believed that God had handed the Torah down to their ancestors a couple thousand years earlier, to Moses. And what the Torah was the Torah was essentially a way of life. The Torah was God saying, this is how to create a life. This is what it looks like to live life in the best possible way. This is what it looks like to live a life following God. This is what it looks like to live a life where you fully enter into your full humanity. And so the Torah, it was called oftentimes the way. It was a teaching. It was instructions about how to live and create your life. And so if you're a part of the Jewish community, when you are young, you are trained in Torah. You're taught how to live your life. Now, one of the questions that was often raised was, how young can we start training our kids? And I'm sure some parents have a couple of thoughts on that one. How young can you be when you start teaching your kids? Now, there's one rabbi, and he has this brilliant quote. He says this. He says, under the age of six, we do not receive a child as a pupil. Oh, a rabbi, by the way, is a religious teacher. And so all the rabbis had different views about things. And so one said, under six, we don't. But from six upwards, accept him and stuff him with Torah like an ox. Oh, I love that. Yeah, so at the age of six, you can start stuffing a student, child, with Torah like an ox. So at the age of six, any six-year-olds here? Didn't think so. They're all in the back room with Rachel. At the age of six, you would enter into your first school, which if we go to the next slide, the first school that you would enter is called the Beit Sefer, also known as the House of the Book. And so at age six, what you would do is you would typically go down the block, and one of the local rabbis at the synagogue right down the street would begin training your child until the age of 10. So from 6 to 10, you're in the House of the Book. And what did you learn in the House of the Book? was all about Torah memorization. So from age 6 to 10, what you would do is you would memorize the entire Torah. Yes, all five of those books. Because think about it. A long, long time ago, in a place far, far away, iPhones did not exist. So you could not just pull your phone out of your pocket and scroll through in order to figure out what Genesis 7 or Leviticus 9 has to say. You had to know it here. Also, you didn't have your own copy of the scriptures. There most likely probably would have been only one copy in your entire village that would be down at the local synagogue. So you couldn't just go home at night and pull something off your shelf and scroll through it. If you wanted to know what the Torah said, if you wanted to know about how to create and live your life, you had to have it memorized. So from 6 to 10, you would be memorizing all those five books of the Bible. Then, the best of the best, only the best of the best, only those who are able to memorize the Torah well would have moved into the next level of education, which is known as the Beit Talmud, also known as the House of Learning. Now, if you were not one of the best, if you weren't good, if you couldn't get through all those different laws and legalities in Leviticus, the rabbi would tell you, good try, it's time for you to go home. Learn the family trade so that you can carry on the family business. So that there'd be a cut. Some people would be sent home, and then others would continue their education. Now, if you were in the house of learning, what would you begin to learn? Well, not only would you have the Torah memorized, but you would now begin to memorize the entirety of the Hebrew scriptures. Yes, all 39 books, Genesis through Malachi. Anyone want to try that one? And just think, you're 10 years old, 10 to about 14 years old, and you're memorizing the entire, just look at that. Anyone have a Bible right here? How many pages? Kind of about that, right? Can we hold that up for us? Yeah, let's give us a glimpse here. It's okay. You don't have to go the whole way. Just kind of, right there. That's good. Perfect. Just hold that up. Show us how many pages that is. You got that. Aaron's got it. There we go. 1,000 pages. 10 to 14 years old, 1,000 pages memorized in your head. Also, what you would learn is you would begin to learn the oral tradition. So you had the Hebrew scriptures, you had these 39 books, but then there was this oral tradition that surrounded each of the verses. So for thousands of years, rabbis, religious teachers, they would look at the scriptures and they would begin to debate the meaning of individual verses. And so this rabbi would say this about this particular verse, but then you'd have another rabbi who would say this about this same verse, which then another rabbi would chime in, and then another one, and then another, and another, because this is what the Jewish religion was all about. It was an endless dialogue. It was an endless debate about how you're to interpret these verses that we find within the scriptures. And so if you're here in the house of learning, you're memorizing the scriptures, but you're also learning the oral tradition that's surrounding each of these verses as well. So you could say, oh, you know, I know what the rabbi said about that. I know what this rabbi said about that verse. I know what this rabbi said about that verse. 10 to 14 years old. Also, you would learn the art of asking questions. If you ever read through the Gospels, you might notice that Jesus asked a whole bunch of questions. This is the rabbinic tradition. Because what the rabbi, they didn't just want to teach to the test as unfortunately we do in schools today. They didn't just say, hey, here's the 10 things to memorize. If you can spit them back, then you get an A, you get a gold star, and you graduate, and you move on to the next level. No, no, no. What the rabbis wanted to know is that you were actually processing this information. And the only way to show that you were processing and wrestling through the information was for you to throw another question back out there. Almost as if you've learned this information, but now you're taking it deeper. You're taking it to the next level. So you're memorizing all of the Hebrew scriptures, you're learning the oral tradition, and you're asking questions. By the time you're 14 years old, most of the students would be sent home to go learn the family business and carry on that business. But if you're the best of the best, then you might continue to the next level of your education, which, if we go to the next slide, is called the Beit Midrash, also known as the House of Study. And if you've memorized everything well, you've learned the art of asking questions, what you would then do is you would go and approach a rabbi who you respected. You would go to a rabbi who you wanted to become just like, and you would say, excuse me, rabbi, I want to become your disciple. I want to follow you. I want to learn to be just like you. Which at that point, what the rabbi would do is the rabbi would begin to grill the student. And he would ask all sorts of different questions in order to discover whether this particular student had what it took in order to be trained by this rabbi. And most of the time, what do you think the rabbis would say? A for effort, go home and learn the family business. You did really well, but you just don't have what it takes to be one of my disciples. But on the other hand, if the rabbi liked what he saw, if you were able to answer the questions in a way that intrigued the rabbi, he would speak three words to you. He would say, come, follow me. Which at that point, the disciple would go and follow the rabbi everywhere he went, including the bathroom. So the goal wasn't just to learn a whole bunch of information, but rather the goal was actually to fully imitate and live exactly how you saw the rabbi living. So if the rabbi prayed a certain prayer, the disciple would learn to pray that prayer. If the rabbi told a certain story, the disciple would learn to tell that story. Every single thing that the rabbi did, what the disciple would try to do is imitate that exactly. There's a certain blessing that developed, and it was, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Because as a disciple, your goal was to be so close, was to be following so close to the rabbi that the dust that was kicked up from his sandals as he was walking would be covering your feet. Your goal as a disciple was to be observing and watching so that you could fully imitate everything that you saw the rabbi do. Now, I understand that this whole idea of discipleship is completely foreign for us today. We don't walk around following rabbis. We don't walk on dusty streets. We don't wear sandals everywhere we go. Maybe some of you do. I don't know. But this whole idea of discipleship, it seems very foreign. It seems very antiquated for us here today. But yet, don't we follow rabbis all the time? Don't we look to people all the time for guidance about how to live life? Don't we look to people all the time to discover what is the best life? What is the type of life that's going to bring me joy and meaning and satisfaction? I found some of the latest statistics back in June of 2017 of some of our modern-day rabbis, some of the more popular people that we follow in the world. Let me show you the top five modern rabbis of the world. Number five. Selena Gomez, 248 million followers on social media. She gets 134,000 average new followers a day. She is number one on Instagram. Number four, Katy Perry, 260 million followers. How many of you follow Katy Perry on social media? Don't be shy about it. I see some of you are like, I'm not going to raise my hand about it. I know George. Number three, the great soccer player, Ronaldo. This one actually surprised me. This surprised anyone else? Number three, most followed person on all of social media, and he's number one on Facebook, 287 million followers. Any guesses on the top two? All right, you guys are in the top 10. Number two, it's like Family Feud, or is that what the game show, Family Feud? Yes. Number two, yes, the survey says Taylor Swift, 288 million followers, and just recently she was passed by, anyone want to give a guess? No. She was like number eight or nine, I think. Number one, Justin Bieber, the Biebs. 294 million followers. Yeah. Some of our modern day rabbis right here. The Biebs. Yeah. See, I would suggest we're all being covered in the dust of rabbis. Whether we're aware of it or not, we're all students. We're all disciples. We're all learning and following someone or some group or some ideology. Yeah, I'd suggest we're all being covered in the dust of rabbis, whether we're aware of it or not. So who are some of the rabbis that you're following? Who are some of the people whose dust you're being covered in? Think about it. Who are the authors that you read? The podcast that you listen to? Who are the people that you allow to speak into your life? Who are your role models? The people who influence your decisions? How you spend your time, your money, what you wear, where you live? Yeah, we're all being covered in the dust of rabbis. And as you think about those that you're following, as you think about the dust that you're being covered in, what type of life do you find yourself creating? Do you find yourself each day being filled with more and more peace? When you think about the people who influence you, do you see your life moving into more and more love for the people around you? Do you find your heart breaking open with compassion for people? Do you find your heart breaking for some of the heartbreak and the brokenness and the devastation that we see all across our country right now? In the world? Are you finding more grace for yourself? As you live each day, do you have a growing awareness of how much you're loved, of how much you're valued, of the great potential that you have within you? As you move forward, are you discovering a greater sense that you have an amazing gift to offer to the world? That your life, the one precious life that you've been given, deeply, deeply matters? When you think about the dust that you're being covered in, are you gaining more compassion for yourself? Do you find your life being filled with more forgiveness for others, for yourself? Yeah, Jesus, the rabbi, he says, my yoke, my way of living, it's easy. My way of living brings a freedom. If you follow me, this way that I am teaching you to set up and live your life, it brings a freedom and the lifting of burdens. And it opens your heart to be more loving and compassionate for the world around you. So when we're here at Awaken and we're talking about forming disciples of Jesus, these are the types of characteristics that we're looking to form within each of us. A life that is marked by love, by grace, by compassion, by mercy, by sacrifice. A life that is marked by being totally confident and secure and at peace exactly where you find yourself, rather than being filled with anxiety that there's somewhere else that you need to be. A life of being perfectly at peace right where you are. I recently came across a description of a pastor who was leaving the pastorate after over 20-plus years of being a pastor. And he started looking for a church himself after being the pastor for 20 years, and he started talking a little bit about the type of church that he was looking for. And I read this, and I was like, yes, this is the type of church we're looking to form here. And I want to read this reflection for you. He says, what I needed as a parishioner was very different from what had preoccupied me as a pastor. I wasn't looking for clever sermons or a certain style of music. I didn't need a church that was cool or contemporary or big or small. I certainly didn't need a church whose primary goal was to police the belief systems of its members. Instead, I wanted and needed a church that would help me live a life of love with as little distraction as possible. I needed sustenance, encouragement, and help in loving God, loving myself, loving my wife, loving my kids and grandkids and extended family, loving my neighbors, especially people I might struggle to love, and loving the earth. I felt that without a community and regular gatherings to help me, I could too easily drift. Too easily shift into autopilot, too easily stagnate and sour. Without intentional care and relevant practices, my soul could grow weary and cold or grow small and dark. I could lose my way easily. I needed a church that would help me live a life of love. I needed a community that would help me be more like Jesus. I needed a community that would help me grow in love for all the people around me. I needed a community that would help me put flesh and blood on the words of Jesus. This is what we're doing here at Awaken. Creating followers who are covered in the dust of Jesus. Now, if we go to Matthew chapter 4, this is when Jesus called his first disciples. And Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee. He saw two brothers, Simon, called Peter, and his brother Andrew. And they were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will send you out to fish for people." So at once they left their nets and they followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James and John, and they were in a boat with their daddy preparing their nets. And so Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father, and they followed him. When Jesus went to call his disciples, what were they doing? They were fishing. In other words, they hadn't made the cut. They had been sent home. They had been told, "You don't really have what it takes to be a rabbi." They were the B team. They were the practice squad. They were told, "You don't qualify to be a rabbi. You don't have what it takes." And what does Jesus do? He walks around and he says, "I choose you. I believe in who you can become. I believe that you can change the world." These disciples, 14 years old, 16, 18, Peter is probably a little bit older, teenagers. They're growing peach fuzz. And yet Jesus walks up to them. "I believe in you. I have faith in the type of person that you can become. You can be just like me." I don't know what this does for you, but this story gives me great hope. Because there's times when I feel inadequate. There's times when I feel that I don't have what it takes. When I feel like a failure. When I don't feel qualified. I look around and there's other people who are smarter, they're more wise, they're better pastors than me. And I think, "Oh, what do I have to offer?" And yet this story tells me that Jesus has been inviting each one of us to follow him because Jesus believes that you have what it takes. Jesus believes that you can change the world. Jesus believes that you have been given a spirit within you that will encourage you and that will give you the strength that you need. Jesus believes that you have been birthed with a divine spark, the image of God that has been breathed deeply into your soul. Jesus believes that you are valued, you matter, and you have amazing potential. You are so worthy. See, this is what Jesus has been doing, calling us back to the people that we were created to be. Because oftentimes we forget. We get beaten down. Others tell us, you're not good enough. You don't qualify. You don't have what it takes. And Jesus comes with a different message and says, that's not true. You're loved. And you're valued. And you matter. And you can change the world. So what I want to do here as we close this morning is I want to celebrate Eucharist, the good gift of Christ that brings healing to the world. And as you come forward, as you take the bread, as you dip it into the cup, may you hear the words of Jesus, this invitation that Jesus offers to come and follow him. And as you walk forward, may you be reminded of your amazing potential, of your worth, of the fact that you've been given grace. You've been given a gift. And with that gift, you've been invited to partner with God in bringing healing and restoration to the world around you. Let me pray here for us. God, we come to you this morning. God, we're humbled. We're humbled by this invitation. God, this invitation to follow Christ. God, we're humbled by the belief that you have in us. God, that we can be people whose lives are marked by love and grace and compassion. God, that we can be people who impact the world, people who change the world. God, people who breathe hope into dark places. So God, I pray as we come forward this morning, God, may your spirit speak words of affirmation, speak words of hope to our soul. God, may we not leave here the same, but God, may we leave here this morning filled with a peace. God, a peace that we have what it takes, that we matter, that we qualify. God, if there's any negative messages that are floating around inside of our heads, God, I ask that you would remove those. God, that your spirit would replace those messages with new messages. So God, we thank you for your grace. We thank you for your love. We pray all this in the name of Jesus. Amen.